is Thursday, July 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. is moving thousands of U.S. troops out of a longtime European ally nation.
These changes will achieve the core principles of enhancing U.S. and NATO deterrence of Russia.
A grim milestone for the U.S. coronavirus pandemic outbreak. Also ahead, NASA set to blast off to Mars on a mission to find evidence of whether life once existed on the red planet. It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. military on Wednesday unveiled plans to withdraw about 12,000 American troops from Germany following a decision by U.S. President Donald Trump. Secretary of Defense Mark Esper said nearly half of them will remain in Europe to address tensions with Russia.
These changes will achieve the core principles of enhancing U.S. and NATO deterrence of Russia, strengthening NATO, reassuring allies, and improving U.S. strategic flexibility and EUCOM operational flexibility.
International Edition's Steve Miller spoke with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden about the impacts and implications of the decision.
Most of the impact is going to be on U.S. European command, again, which has been more heavily stationed in Germany than anywhere else. As of right now, there are about 36,000 to 38,000 U.S. troops in Germany at numerous installations, many of them famous and well-known, such as Ramstein Air Base. In addition, Stuttgart, Germany has been home to U.S. European command. European command now is going to move to Belgium, so Germany loses that U.S. European command and about 2,000 troops as part of that. There's also the talk that U.S. Africa command now may be leaving, though those plans are not set in stone, and another location, according to officials, is still up in the air. They haven't chosen anything. But clearly, the U.S. is sending a message to Germany. What that message is, it depends on whom you talk to. The president back in June made very clear at a White House news conference with the Polish prime minister that he thought Germany was being very unfair to the U.S. Germany is one of the NATO countries that is not meeting the spending requirements on defense. A few of them are, although defense spending has increased across the NATO alliance, Germany is spending less than 2% of its GDP on defense, and it's committed to spending more. President Trump says that's unfair. And as a result, he said in June, the U.S. was going to be reducing its footprint in Germany. Mark Esper was asked about this, about whether Germany was being punished. And Esper was adamant that while Germany should be spending more, that this was not a punishment, that these moves have been under consideration for quite some time. And the goal is to make the U.S. more flexible, more strategic, and better able to deter Russian aggression, especially on NATO's eastern flank. And he pointed to the rotational deployments that are going to be coming up, where U.S. forces will be sent to the Black Sea region, which is much closer to Russia than Germany is, as a way to deter Russia. And he said that was the goal.
Norbert Röttgen, who is a senior member of Chancellor Angela Merkel's government in Germany, has called the decision a move to weaken the alliance of NATO. Did Secretary Esper or anyone else at the briefing comment about what they thought this would do to the overall strength of the organization?
Esper and the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General John Hyden, said that they believed, in addition to the commander of U.S. European Command, also spoke. They all said that this is going to make the alliance stronger. It is going to make NATO and the U.S. more responsive to the threats that are out there, specifically in this case from Russia on NATO's eastern flank. And it's going to allow the troops to be more focused on that mission of deterrence.
One last question. Moving troops is not inexpensive, and Congress holds the purse strings. So how is this all going to be paid for?
Pentagon officials, including Defense Secretary Mark Esper, said that they will be working with Congress. They will be consulting Congress on the moves. They seemed to indicate that would be more on for the U.S. forces that are coming back. They said the rough estimates, and they emphasized that they were rough estimates, is that it's going to cost billions of dollars, probably under $10 billion.
VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden speaking to International Edition's Steve Miller. The United States passed a somber milestone on Wednesday in its battle against the COVID-19 pandemic. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The worldwide toll is more than 500,000, and Johns Hopkins University's tally shows the U.S. has the most by far. The grim milestone comes amid spikes in various parts of the nation, including Florida, which reported 216 deaths today, breaking the single-day record set just yesterday. Visiting Texas, where the virus has also been surging, President Trump says the nation's making progress.
Together we will end the plague from China. We will defeat the virus.
And as he promises an economic recovery, Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell says the path forward remains extraordinarily uncertain.
And will depend in large part on our success in keeping the virus in check.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Friday's looming expiration of federal assistance tied to the COVID-19 pandemic threatens to cut a financial lifeline for tens of millions of Americans. With time running out, Republicans and Democrats reportedly remain far apart on a possible extension of benefits. VOA's Mariama Diallo has the story of one COVID survivor struggling to pay medical bills who desperately needs federal relief to continue.
Medical bills are piling up for Aisha Brown, who survived the coronavirus.
You got to call the people and let them know, like, you know, this is what's going on. I was sick. I'm sorry I can't pay this bill.
The Maryland resident spent a month in the hospital where she endured a medically induced coma and three blood transfusions.
This really got harder for us because it was like, how are we going to pay this and where the money going to come from?
The Salvation Army has helped Brown pay her electric bills. The group is among many urging lawmakers to quickly pass a new relief bill before the current one expires on Friday, leaving people like Brown without a major source of income during the pandemic.
If my message to lawmakers can be one thing, is really take a day and walk in the shoes of the families who have to make these critical decisions.
The roughly $2 trillion Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act included payments of up to $1,200 for individuals with income under $99,000, plus $500 per child and an additional $600 federal payment a week added to unemployment benefits. With CARES Act payments set to expire on Monday, Senate Republicans announced a $1 trillion plan for a new aid package.
I think this is a starting place. You can see that we've had a lot of our members involved in the start, and we can't pass a bill in the Senate without Democrats.
That plan would trim weekly payments to $200, an amount Democrats say is insufficient. Democrats want more generous benefits to continue as part of a $3 trillion plan.
People are being on the verge of eviction because they can't pay the rent. They've lost their jobs through no fault of their own. And again, families can't pay the rent. And they are resenting the fact that people were getting $600, which was helping to keep them out of poverty and make ends meet.
With the two sides still at odds, the Trump administration says it's considering a short-term plan to prevent millions from losing aid if a deal isn't reached by Friday.
As of now, we're very far apart because of that. The president and we had discussed a short-term extension to UI and
Meanwhile, Brown waits to see what happens in Washington. Having survived as a COVID patient, she now looks to survive the financial fallout of the pandemic. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Cases of COVID-19 are increasing daily in the Palestinian West Bank, with the virus epicenter in the city of Hebron. Health and economic crisis has been exacerbated after the Palestinian Authority cut off ties with Israel in protest against Israel's planned annexation of the West Bank. The World Bank this week announced a $30 million grant for emergency aid to the West Bank and for creating more jobs. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Another funeral in Hebron, a victim of COVID-19's resurgence in the Palestinian West Bank. Hebron has reported more than half of the infections.
Hebron is a big city with tribal systems, and there are weddings. This is the summer, and it's the season for weddings and celebrations of all kinds, and people get together. without knowing that they are carrying the virus or not.
As Palestinians suffer another wave of economic closures, the population has begun to express frustration and resentment with the Palestinian Authority leadership.
The government is scaring people from going out because of the coronavirus, and the merchants have no customers. The markets are empty. There is no work. What plan does the government have to help people and merchants go on? If we don't die from the corona, should we die starving in this country?
Many Palestinians thought their government was performing well at the beginning of the pandemic, when infection numbers were low. They also supported its decision to cut off all ties and cooperation with Israel after Israel announced it would annex part of the West Bank. The annexation hasn't happened yet. But the breakdown of ties has led to more economic hardship in the Palestinian Authority, and Palestinian health officials say the number of people asking to go to Israel for medical treatment has dropped by 90%.
Because of this lack of this stopping of cooperation, the tax revenues that Israel provides to the Palestinian government have not been coming through, and so there's really a shortage of resources in terms of being able to provide the necessary means in terms of healthcare services and supplies. And but of course, it's important to note that, you know, as an occupying force, Israel is responsible to ensure that healthcare is provided in the occupied territories, and that's essential.
Fearing a humanitarian collapse in the Palestinian West Bank, international aid workers are trying to facilitate shipments of medical aid. As seen in this video provided by Chinese state television, one such shipment recently arrived from China.
There are huge challenges at the moment with importing humanitarian shipments, and that's related to the suspension of the coordination between Israel and the Palestinian Authority in response to the annexation. So we are working very closely with other UN agencies to find an alternative mechanism to clear those humanitarian shipments. There are some 30 shipments at the moment pending.
Palestinians are set to celebrate a major Muslim holiday, Eid al-Adha, the Feast of the Sacrifice. But authorities warn that mass gatherings spread the coronavirus, and many Palestinians say they don't feel much like celebrating. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
After suspected Rwandan genocide financier Felicien Kabuga's arrest earlier this year, another genocide suspect and French resident, Rwandan military official Aloys Ntirugab, is under investigation in France. Lisa Bryant reports from Paris that this latest discovery is raising questions about why French authorities didn't act sooner and how many others may be in the country.
In an interview with VOA, lawyer Benjamin Shui says his client, Aloys Ntirugab, has been living in France for years. One of two lawyers defending Ntirugab, Shui said French authorities have been fully aware of his client's whereabouts since Ntirugab applied for legal status here. French judicial authorities said Saturday they had opened a crimes against humanity probe targeting Ntirugab. The move followed a report by investigative news site Mediapart, which tracked the former intelligence chief and his wife to a suburb of Orléans, about 110 kilometers south of Paris. The former International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, or ICTR, once identified Ntirugab as one of the architects of the Rwandan genocide that killed about 800,000 people. But the AFP news agency reports the ICTR, now succeeded by another mechanism, had long ago dropped an arrest warrant against Ntirugab, as did French and Rwandan authorities. Reports suggest investigators seem to have lost track of him years ago. Lawyer Shui says his client was not in hiding.
He says
Ntiwiragabo never hid his real identity in France and is available now to answer investigators' questions. His client strongly contests the Mediapart report, Shui says, and insists he played no role in the genocide. Radio France International reports Ntiwiragabo remained in Rwanda's military during the genocide, but at least initially cited against a key organizer of the killings. Ntiwiragabo also authored a 2018 book offering his version of the broader 1990s Great Lakes conflict through French publishing house Edition Scribe. The French probe into his actions follows the May arrest in France of another major genocide suspect. Félicien Kabouga is accused of bankrolling the genocide. The 84-year-old had been hiding for years outside Paris and is now appealing his transfer to Arusha, Tanzania, to face trial.
Nous avons déposé plus d'une trentaine de plaintes. Quand on me pose la question,
Alain Gauthier, who heads a French genocide survivors group, estimates several dozen other suspects remain at large in France. He denounces the slowness of France's judicial system. Other alleged suspects include Agathe Habyarimana, widow of the former Rwandan president whose death helped trigger the genocide. She lives outside of Paris. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
French police dismantled a migrant camp northeast of Paris. Authorities have repeatedly dismantled illegal campsites only for them to pop up again elsewhere within months. Joining us now for the latest is Paris-based reporter Catherine Field. Officials there warned they would be taking this camp down. So what's the latest and where are the migrants now?
Police moved in at dawn, which has been the sort of regular way that they've been going about these clearances. They moved in, buses were at the ready, and some 2,113 migrants were rehoused in the course of this operation. The migrants are mostly men. They're from Afghanistan, Ethiopia, Sudan, and Chad. They've been living in this camp alongside the canal just north of Paris for several months. They have allegedly been taken to temporary accommodation in the area. And by temporary accommodation, the state means that disused sports halls, sometimes schools that are closed over the summer period, and that there they will be given the opportunity to present their papers to officials. They will also get health checks, and they will also be told what sort of hope they have of ever being given permanent residency here in France.
Are they seeking asylum? I know that many of them have come from countries blighted by war and poverty. Are they looking for visas or citizenship?
Essentially, at this stage, what they're hoping for is to be given some sort of chance at permanent residency in France. Some of them admit they might not fit the status of a refugee or the status of an unaccompanied minor and danger. They just want somewhere where they can at least have a roof over their head, the possibility of getting an education for some of them, the possibility of even some sort of job. Again, though, this is France in COVID semi-lockdown situation where you don't have the government departments at full strength, you don't have any of the schools or any of the facilities for learning languages aren't open, they possibly won't be open again this year. So it's a difficult time for these migrants to be here asking for this because there's such a logjam.
Right. And of course, dealing with the pandemic on top of that. What about the other migrant camp that we also recently spoke about in Paris, where unaccompanied minors were staying? Are they still there?
They are. A month on from when NGOs set up this camp for the some 100 unaccompanied minors, mostly from Guinea, Côte d'Ivoire, they are still there, bang in the center of Paris, Place de la République. The NGOs that are supporting them say they're absolutely flabbergasted that the state hasn't moved in to help these unaccompanied minors. The state, for their part, says, look, we are part of a big European Union program to help unaccompanied minors who are in camps in Greece. Let's not forget, in those camps in Greece, there are some 5,000 unaccompanied minors there. Of that, the European Union has said they will distribute 1,600 across Europe. France has said they will take 350 of them. Already this week, we've seen 16 of those unaccompanied minors being moved to Finland. They were 16 unaccompanied minors from Somalia and Congo. Earlier on in the week, there were 83 vulnerable families also moved out of those camps in Greece. So essentially, the French are saying, we'll do it through the legal channels. We will not be balanced into taking in unaccompanied minors or those who say they're unaccompanied minors who are just turning up on our doorstep. You have to go through the process, however long, however difficult it might be. The UNHCR and the IOM, they're saying, is the appropriate channel.
Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you so much. Well, refugee and migration agencies are launching a report that recounts the death, suffering, and extreme human rights abuses experienced by thousands of refugees and migrants on irregular journeys between West and East Africa and Africa's Mediterranean coast. Lisa Schlein brings us this report for VOA from Geneva.
Around 16,000 refugees and migrants surveyed over the last 2 years have described the brutality and inhumanity suffered at the hands of smugglers, traffickers, militias, and even government officials. The UN Refugee Agency's Special Envoy for the Central Mediterranean, Vincent Costel, says 47% of the victims have reported the perpetrators of violence were law enforcement authorities.
Whereas in the past, we believed that it was mainly smugglers and traffickers. Yes, they are key perpetrators of violence, but the primary perpetrators of violence are people who are supposed to protect.
The report documents at least 72 deaths a month for a total of 1,750 fatalities in 2018 and 2019, making the desert route one of the deadliest in the world. Authors of the report suggest the number is greatly underestimated. Ayala Erin Bonfilio is regional coordinator for the Mixed Migration Center North Africa. She says 43% of refugees and migrants surveyed in Libya cited it as the most dangerous country on the migratory route, followed by Niger, Algeria, and Mali.
The main threats in Libya include physical violence, followed by detention, death, robbery, and sexual violence. Men are more vulnerable compared to women. However, women were considerably more likely to experience or witness sexual abuse. And the reason for men being more vulnerable on the whole could, for instance, in the case of detention, be related to the fact that detention was linked to forced labor, and so they were commodified.
The report says the men, women, and children who survive the horrific ordeals they have suffered often are left with lasting and severe mental health issues due to trauma. Thousands of refugees and migrants who arrive in Libya and make the sea crossing to Europe are intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard and returned to Libya. Many are held in official government detention centers where they reportedly face abuse. Many others, the report says, end up in unofficial centers or warehouses controlled by smugglers and traffickers who physically abuse them to extract payments for their release. The refugee and migration agencies say these vulnerable people should under no circumstances be returned to Libya, as it is not a safe place. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hong Kong police arrested four people Wednesday from the ages of 16 to 21 for suspected offenses under the city's new national security law. The first such detentions outside of street protests since the legislation took effect a month ago. In a press conference shortly before midnight on Wednesday, a police spokesman said the three men and a woman, all students, were suspected of being involved in an online group that pledged to use every means to fight for an independent Hong Kong. A group of lawmakers in Mali will not resign despite the recommendation to do so by West Africa's regional body. The decision deals a further blow to efforts to find a peaceful resolution to Mali's months-long political crisis. On Monday, the Economic Community of West African States suggested 31 members of parliament whose elections were contested stepped down, among a number of proposals intended to appease an opposition coalition that has held large-scale protests calling for the president's resignation. You're listening to International Edition. The summer's third and final mission to Mars, featuring NASA's most elaborate life-hunting rover, is on the verge of liftoff later today. The rover Perseverance spacecraft, along with its detachable space helicopter Ingenuity. It'll take 7 months to reach Mars after traveling 300 million miles. NASA project scientist Kenneth Farley says they'll start off with some very basic maneuvers for the helicopter.
We'll start off with very simple things, such as rising up above the ground and hovering, and then landing successfully. And then we'll do increasingly complex patterns that will demonstrate the capability of the helicopter to both fly and navigate.
Still, Farley says the Ingenuity helicopter does have its limitations.
The helicopter can only fly a couple of minutes before it needs to land and recharge. And this means that we have to be very careful how we design each flight.
Once on the surface, Perseverance will scrounge for evidence of past microscopic life in an ancient lake bed and gather the most promising rock samples for future pickup. NASA is teaming up with the European Space Agency to return the samples to Earth around 2031. With the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, engaged couples are having to rethink their wedding plans. As VOA's David Byrd reports, some couples are opting for tiny weddings with fewer guests, social distancing, and other protections.
Picture a wedding. The couple, their families and friends and guests, music, a cake, an officiant, flowers, photos, maybe even some dancing and celebration. Now picture that not happening because of the coronavirus pandemic. Couples plan weddings sometimes years in advance, but with the pandemic closing venues and forcing smaller gatherings, some couples, like Ashley and Austin Butterfield, are having to improvise. Ashley told the Associated Press that they found a way to have their ceremony and still be safe, a tiny wedding.
We found out about the tiny weddings actually through a Google search in a panic of, our December wedding has been canceled, what do we do? So thankfully, we were able to actually get a slot because they were filling up so quickly.
The venue they chose, Zingerman's Cornman Farm in Dexter, Michigan, outside Detroit, features a tiny wedding that includes venue rental, flowers, a photo shoot, a ceremony, an officiant, a wedding cake, and even champagne. Couples are permitted to invite no more than 8 guests. The Butterfields had 5. Ashley Butterfield says that turning away family members and friends was difficult, but the celebration was a success.
There were family members that definitely wanted to be here and didn't understand when we say tiny wedding, we mean a tiny wedding. But I think once they see some of the pictures and they see what venue we had, they'll understand and they'll be happy for us.
The couple saved on the cost as well. The tiny wedding packages start at around $2,000. The wedding planning website, theknot.com, says the average wedding in the United States sets families back around $34,000. The Butterfields hope to have a renewal of vows next year when, they hope, the impact of the pandemic will have abated. Ashley says that disappointed couples can have a beautiful wedding, even if it has to be smaller.
I guess just to any other bride that's had their 2020 wedding canceled, I know it's hard, I know it's heartbreaking, but try and be creative. There are so many options for you. You can have everything you dreamed of in 2020, I promise.
The Knot.com site says there were approximately 550,000 weddings planned for April to June of this year. The site says that worldwide, nearly 93% of couples have had to reschedule. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Check me out, turn the music up, yeah.
And Malik B, a rapper and founding member of The Roots, has died. The group announced the death of the Philadelphia-based MC in a social media post Wednesday. Malik B was a major contributor to the group, appearing on 4 albums before departing in 1999. In the following year, The Roots won their first Grammy Award. Malik B was 47. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vundani, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great day.
Let the smoke fall. You gotta understand the joker, he's a dope mode. Brain soaked in the stained cloak by the boatload. I got a dope, period, get a yoke code. Give me that respect, that Malcolm X in the pole. Philly resident, the drama's always evident. Suckers not in my job description's why I'm hesitant. I'm trying to make a meal, the judge got me to take a deal. I don't know how a faker feel, show you how my fate is real. I bring power to strength, bring a yardage of length, because she's a nymph. When I aim and start to squeeze and buck, better duck, this soldier never buck.